You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new documentary marks 50 years since the creation of UW-Madison's only newspaper by and for Black students. We talked to the director of the documentary and a reporter for the paper in its early days during the 1970s. Now, Russia's attack in Ukraine is in its fifth day. The two sides met today for peace talks that are set to continue later this week. A number of countries across the world have condemned Putin's invasion, and the United States and other Western powers have stepped up their sanctions against Russia. Military, financial, and humanitarian aid is flowing into Ukraine, but the country's leaders say they're going to need more. We're checking in on the latest developments out of Ukraine to try and figure out what could happen next, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the reports coming out of Ukraine? Are you hopeful that the conflict could end soon? What do you think of the sanctions piling up from countries around the world? Do you think there needs to be more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Lussier is an associate professor of political science at Grinnell College. She's chair of the Department of Russian, Central European, and Eurasian Studies there and chair of the Department of Political Science. Danielle, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It feels like a lifetime in some ways, just a handful of days. What are your thoughts now 5 days into this Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Oh, that's a great question. I do feel like it's been a very overwhelming last 5 days. As someone who watches this region very closely, for the last several weeks, we've been paying attention to changes on the ground and changes in the geopolitical atmosphere. I think things started to take a very ominous turn really a week ago when President Putin first recognized Donetsk and Luhansk as autonomous regions and then gave this very bizarre statement to the Russian public that made just some very aggressive claims that would suggest that things were taking a very ominous turn. That being said, I didn't necessarily anticipate a full invasion on Thursday. So now that we're 5 days into this, I think we're at a very interesting juncture. We've seen that Ukraine is proving itself to be very resilient to a military invasion for which it was unprepared. It's stayed very resilient militarily. It stayed very resilient politically. We've seen allies come together very quickly to put together a very aggressive plan of action to try to force the Russian government out of its economic comfort zone. So I'm thinking we're at a really interesting turning point right now.
The United Nations made a rare move to convene its General Assembly in a special session, many countries calling for an end to the war. I'm going to give a listen to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressing the situation in his speech to open that session earlier today.
We need to look forward as United Nations to overcome the scourge of war. We need to focus on solving problems, not making them worse. In cities around the world, people are taking to the streets and demanding an end to war. People in Ukraine want and need peace. And I believe people in the Russian Federation do too. We need peace now.
The international response, we're seeing traditionally neutral countries like Switzerland stepping up and saying, yeah, we're going to hold Russian assets for now. Sweden and Finland contributing military aid to Ukraine. What do you make of this? And now Germany also widening its support for Ukraine. What do you make of this increase in the number of countries and the intensity of the support they're giving sanctions and to helping Ukraine?
I'm impressed with how quickly it has come together. I think obviously Switzerland setting aside its neutrality is a very important piece of this puzzle, because ultimately what we're seeing from Vladimir Putin is that he's not willing to simply come to the negotiation table. He needs to actually be forced to that negotiation table. He needs to feel it in such a way where he can no longer support this war. And it seems to be that a unified financial intervention is what's necessary. And Switzerland was a really important part of this. But it's not just Switzerland. I mean, obviously, that's a very significant piece. But I would say an even bigger piece has to do with the number of countries that have come together to essentially force the Russian central bank to have insufficient access to its currency reserves. These are absolutely necessary to prop up the Russian ruble. Without having access to the types of reserves that are held in foreign banks, it will be impossible for the Russian central bank to maintain its currency. The ruble is already losing its value very, very rapidly. We're likely to see a very strong and devastating impact on the Russian economy that will be impossible for Putin to avoid.
We're talking to Danielle Lussier from Grinnell College, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about the news you're seeing from around the world, 800-642-1234. What you want to hear from President Biden, maybe at the State of the Union address tomorrow, what actions you ought to see taken or not taken in response, 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. It's been hazy, Danielle, as to what Vladimir Putin had hoped to get out of this. Are we starting to get a clear picture of what he was hoping the end game of this invasion would look like?
I think he was certainly hoping that it was going to go much more quickly. As best as we can tell right now, we see very little reason to think that he was prepared for a long-term invasion, right? We have troops that are running out of gas on the ground. He expected to be able to go in and essentially topple the Ukrainian government very quickly and then be able to negotiate some sort of ceasefire that would lead to a long-term political control, over Ukraine. I think going in, he envisioned being able to bring Ukraine, at least initially, back into Russian political control and ultimately potentially strengthen his overall grip on a number of different territories that had predominantly been part of the Russian Empire. Now, I think that since this has not gone as quickly or smoothly as he envisioned, the end game might be different. I don't think he was prepared for a war that would last many months. I certainly don't think he was prepared for having access to foreign Russian central bank assets being frozen and the inability to conduct a lot of Russian economic practices being crippled as a result.
One of the big stories of the last bunch of years has been misinformation campaigns interfering in elections around the world, including the U.S., but not limited to the U.S. And a lot of efforts seemed pointed toward breaking up NATO, creating divisions within NATO. It seems like this invasion, if there was any progress on that front, this invasion has just removed all of that. Did this backfire in a way that Putin may not have expected?
I think that's exactly right. I think part of the, thinking about the role of NATO in all of this, one wants to just sort of bear in mind that Ukraine has aspired for greater European integration for many years now, economic integration, but of course also wanting security guarantees. And those security guarantees go all the way back to the early 1990s when the Soviet Union was first dissolved, when Ukraine agreed to return the nuclear weapons that were on its territory back to Russia, primarily for the overall security of the nuclear complex. And in doing so, did so in an environment in which it never perceived itself as potentially being on the receiving end of a Russian military attack. The slow move or the gradual move that Ukraine has sought to gain greater integration into European economic and security structures over time has been perceived by Russia as being very, very threatening. And I would say many scholars, myself included, look at various types of Russian intervention into Ukrainian domestic politics going back over the past 20 years as one of the goals of that being to essentially make Ukraine so unstable as to make it impossible for it to join the European Union or ultimately to enter into NATO. So this goal here that I think has had for many years has to do with reducing these opportunities to bring NATO closer to the Russian border. And I think it's backfired by showing the strength. I mean, again, seeing Germany agree to meet its NATO commitments in terms of contributions to military armaments, et cetera. This has been something that I don't think Russia was counting on.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Michelle is with us in Madison. Michelle, hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. My question is regarding this sham negotiation table that Ukraine has been brought to, which appears to be purely about Russian grandstanding. I have a fear that the reason Putin demanded this show was because there is something that he wants people to be distracted from, or some action that he is buying time in order to be able to take. And I just wonder if anybody has been addressing these sorts of concerns or has any thoughts about what might be going on.
Michelle, thanks for the call. Danielle, it didn't see, in hindsight now, it seems like Putin wasn't negotiating in good faith leading up to last week. Is there any reason to think he might be negotiating in good faith starting this week?
No, I don't think so. But I do wonder if part of what he's trying to get out of this situation would be, you know, now that it's very clear that he's prepared to continue and to continue in a very aggressive and dangerous manner, I wonder if he's thinking, okay, what can I get to extract out of the situation? So maybe I'm not going to get everything that I wanted. Could I still walk out of this situation potentially with something else? So for example, and I've seen this reported in a couple of places in the press, but again, none of this can be verified, that Putin was planning to go into today's negotiations with a demand that the international community recognize the sovereignty of Crimea. So for example, Crimea has been under de facto Russian control now for 8 years, but it continues to be recognized by the United Nations and the international community as being part of Ukraine. And the United Nations General Assembly voted to reaffirm that as early just in December 2019. So this has been an ongoing issue where the international community continues to recognize Crimea as being part of Ukraine's territory. Putin may be going into this saying, okay, look, give me Crimea, and I'm willing to consider a negotiation to cease other types of hostilities. Or let's recognize, for example, internationally recognize these two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine, and let's maybe put forward in a couple of years a referendum that they could join Russia. So he may be trying to see what he could extract out of the situation to make it look like some type of domestic win. Therefore, you know, ending other types of ending sanctions and being able to move forward and saving some face.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Grinnell College political science professor Danielle Lussier about the latest developments in Ukraine. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the global response to the invasion of Ukraine. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our talk now with Danielle Lussier, political science professor at Grinnell College, with us today checking in on how Ukraine and the world are responding to Russia's invasion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the international response has been strong enough? Do you worry about Russia's nuclear capabilities? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Chad is with us in Reedsburg. Chad, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I have a quick question. So let's say that the sanctions do take hold and Russia is forced out for whatever reason. Is there going to be some penalty that Russia will have to face beyond that? So if they move out tomorrow, do the sanctions immediately stop? Or do we take Crimea back? Is the sanction continue? I'll take my call offline.
Thanks for the call. If this problem resolved quickly, what would happen next, Danielle?
That's a great question. It's kind of amazing the number of different instruments that were put into place in the past 5 days. And I don't think that any of those would disappear overnight, right? I think that we would see that there would be a gradual rollback of some of the sanctions, probably based on different elements of demilitarization. I mean, at this point, Russia has put, by best estimates, over 150,000 or approximately 150,000 troops into Ukraine. It has engaged in a wide range of other types of damages. Now, there are a couple of really important things that I think would probably be tied to some type of conditionality here as well, that the separatist regions in eastern Ukraine, which have been active, you know, militant military zones for 8 years, with some exception. There's been some peaceful moments, of course. Russia has never taken responsibility for arming those regions, right? Those are areas that are called, they are termed as separatists, but there seems to be quite a bit of evidence suggesting that the armaments that have been used in that territory were brought in by Russia. So I could envision that there would be a range of different bits of conditionality that would have to come out before different types of sanctions would be reopened. I think the question of the status of Crimea, and I think the question of the status of these other regions would also probably need to be further discussed. I suspect, though, that there's going to have to be a very broader conversation that happens within the United Nations Security Council, as well as within sort of the broader international community, in the sense of, this has been the biggest assault in Europe that we have seen since World War II. I'm not quite sure what types of punishments Vladimir Putin will have to experience, but I don't think that it is going to be as simple as just lifting sanctions. I think that there's something much greater that's going to come out as a result of this. And I think that what we've seen so far, that's probably something that's going to come out when there's collective agreement among allies about what type of consequences Putin and Russia should face.
Thanks for that call, Chad. I wanted to ask you, Danielle, I know you've in the past had your eye on Russian public opinion, protest and dissent in that country. From as far as we can tell from our vantage here in the Midwest, what are we seeing when it comes to the reaction to the war from Russian people?
That's a great question. And I think that we have to sort of divide up the different categories of the population, if you will. There has been a very strong and immediate calls of dissent from, I would say, the intellectual and artistic class, the leadership in Russia. There is an open letter of protest that's been circulated by Russian scholars and universities. There have been any number of musicians and members of the cultural elite who have spoken out against the war very vocally. There have also been a number of individuals out trying to protest the war. Of course, something we have to really think about is that Russia is a very autocratic regime. It is, one might even argue, in some places, it's a police state. So engaging in any street level protest is very dangerous. And yet, even within that, we see that people are going out there and they're facing the possibility of arrest, especially in some large cities. Now, the other piece that we need to think about is that Russian television media is state controlled and it's spewing an awful lot of propaganda right now. So the average Russian who maybe hasn't been following these details very, very closely went into last week with public opinion that looks sort of the following. You know, about 40% or more thought that the recent buildup in tensions between Ukraine and Russia was a result of the West, that this was something that the West had introduced. We have some data from about a month ago that suggested at that point in time that fewer than 10% of Russians wanted to see military action in Ukraine or wanted to support Russian military action in Ukraine. However, there was a much larger percent of the population that was willing to support, if these eastern territories in Ukraine wanted to separate on their own, they could. Now, I think we have some reason to believe that this propaganda is really working in some segments of the Russian population, that there are people who believe Vladimir Putin when he says that this is necessary. At the same time, I don't know that we have a good sense of how well many Russians understand what is entirely going on. There are many who seem to be very skeptical of the information that they're receiving, but at the same time, they're skeptical enough of other types of sources that they're having a hard time discerning the truth of what's in here. I do think that we'll see more anti-war support, if you will, or more anti-war sentiment expressed as the economy starts to collapse.
Time for one more caller. Stephen is with us in Cumberland. Stephen, hi.
Hi. Glad to talk to you.
What did you want to bring up, Stephen?
I have a question and a proposal. I have been watching this conflict and have a feeling that there is an issue of Putin's legacy involved here from a much broader perspective than specific challenges to specific pieces of land like Crimea or the eastern regions. And my theory is this, that I think he is trying to cement his legacy at the end of his regime. And the final piece is the Ukraine, and he has announced that he wants to replace the leadership. The only way he can do that, in my opinion, observing what's going on, is to impose such pain on the population that the decency and the honorability of this distinguished man, Zelensky, has no choice but to resign on behalf of the humanitarian interests of his population.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Just a little over a minute left, Danielle. Is that a worry that the next step might be to inflict such widespread punishment on the Ukrainian population?
I would not put that past Vladimir Putin. And I agree with this caller. I think that Putin, this is what Putin wants for his legacy. He wants to reunite those great Russian lands. But I am more optimistic in the sense that I think we've seen such resolve among the Ukrainian people, and we've seen allies come in and really bolster up the regime and bolster up the state in ways that they can. And so I'm more optimistic that it will be impossible for Vladimir Putin to accomplish that goal.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Just in our last minute, Danielle, what things are changing and quickly, what do you have your eye on next?
What I have my eye on right now has to do with this possible potential movement into the EU. I'm really interested in seeing what's going to happen with these negotiations potentially continuing. And I'm also really, I'm watching also just to see how much more the Ukrainian resistance can continue, given that it's getting fresh supplies and more resources.
Danielle, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Danielle Lussier is an associate professor of political science at Grinnell College. She focuses on Russia and Eastern Europe in her work. She's the chair there of the Department of Political Science. She was with us today talking about the Russian war on Ukraine and where things go from here. Stay up to date on the latest news from Ukraine here on the Ideas Network. NPR will be bringing updates throughout the day. You can also go to WPR.org. Our colleagues at NPR, their reporting will show up there as well. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer Kent and her guest for a preview of the State of the Union address, and let us know what you want to hear from President Biden. You can get that preview. We'll do a post view on Wednesday, and you can of course, hear the actual event itself. Tune in to any of our Wisconsin public radio stations around the state or listen live at WPR.org to tomorrow night's State of the Union address from President Biden. You can get a head start on it. Let us know what you want to hear from the president. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's State of the Union coverage tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Russia's attack on Ukraine means oil prices will most likely continue to rise. We'll talk about what that means for consumers and what to expect at the pump in the future. Now, a new documentary called We the Vision tells the story of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's only newspaper by and for Black students. The paper is called The Black Voice. It was created in the early 1970s and shut down after a few years. In 2015, a student decided to bring it back, and they've been reporting stories ever since. Niall Lansana is director of We the Vision. He was also co-editor-in-chief of The Black Voice in the 2020-21 school year. Niall, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, how you doing, Rob?
Good. And Alexis Yancey is an Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist. She's from Milwaukee and was a reporter for The Black Voice in the 70s. Alexis, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Niall, let's start with you. Why was it important for you to tell the story of The Black Voice in this documentary?
I think that there has been such an important history and such an important legacy of journalists and excellent students that have come up through The Black Voice. And it is a story that is unsung and untold and uncelebrated. And as someone who came through The Black Voice, I was honored to be able to have the opportunity to tell that story in documentary format, because The Black Voice has been amplifying Black voices and students from marginalized communities on UW-Madison's campus for generations. And it's been like super wonderful to see all of that pertinent history come together in this documentary.
Alexis, you reported for The Black Voice in its first incarnation in the 70s. Can you talk about what the creation and then working at The Black Voice meant back then?
It was exciting. Here you know, we were given a chance to get out in the field and report outside of the classroom. And for Black students, journalism was really new to us at that time. And so we were really pioneering in the field. And so it was wonderful to be able to have a place to be able to report on issues that were affecting us on campus, as well as what was going on campus and at other Black colleges and in Black communities across the nation.
Niall, an important part of the story for you is why the Black voice was needed, you say, then and now. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. The Black voice was needed then because there was no space for Black students to share their stories on campus. And coming out of the 1969 Black student strike, those students like Alexis saw how necessary it was to be able to express themselves freely and make sure that they're lifting each other's voices up as a means of like being able to go through the day-to-day struggles of being a Black student on UW-Madison's campus. And like, I think it was wild to see in going through the university archives and reading some of the first iterations of the Black voice, how the issues that they were going through in the 70s is a lot of the same stuff that we're talking about now, but also like just like they had poems back then. Like myself, I'm a poet, being able to see how they expressed joy and they expressed and how they built community through journalism is the exact same way that I was able to do it when I was coming through the Black voice. And I think the documentary We the Vision does a beautiful job of exemplifying that.
Alexis, you went on to a career in journalism, as I mentioned. How did your time with the Black voice as a student influence you as a journalist?
It was a tremendous influence, especially under the direction of Assistant Professor Pam Johnson, the first Black professor that I had in Madison and the first Black woman to teach, male or female, I believe, in the J School at the University of Wisconsin. And so being able to report for the Black voice, and also I reported the news segment on Blackness Radio, and that actually spurred my career into television journalism. And so it was very influential for me.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, how, you know, getting clips in the paper, getting that broadcast experience, did it help open up professional opportunities for you? Because I think a lot of times you apply for a journalism job, they want to see your clips.
Exactly. And basically at that time, what you had was what we did for the Black voice, what I did for Blackness, and what I did for my classes. And eventually in my senior year, I was actually able to do some couple of reports for one of the television stations in Madison. But I couldn't have gotten there without the experience that I had at the Black voice and Blackness.
Niall, Alexis mentioned earlier that a career in journalism, the door didn't necessarily look open to Black students in the 70s. There are still reports that Black reporters are underrepresented in the media. Are you hoping the new incarnation of the Black voice could be part of solving that?
Absolutely. I think that the quality has never lacked with Black journalists. It's about the opportunities. It's about the doors being open. And we've been banging on the door for decades, and we're going to continue to bang on the door because our stories are worthy of being told. And we are excellent at telling those stories and making those connections. Like some of the students that have come through the Black voice have interned at Essence Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, like some of the best publications in the country. And that's not going to change. And all of that work is coming from the Black voice. All of those students are coming through the Black voice. And it has been such an empowering resource and platform for myself, and I know for many other of the students who come through.
Alexis, as we wrap up, what does it mean for you to, you know, to have done this in the 70s and then a new generation picks up the torch years later?
It's really great to see. I myself, as one of those people who rose to the ranks of being a network news producer at CBS News, it is inspiring because we have paved the way for others to come behind us. And that's what we wanted to do. And we have thousands in media right now, but at now there's more thousands more media outlets, but it's still, we still aren't represented fully in each of those organizations. And so it's very important for us to continue the legacy and for us to mentor more journalists coming into the field who are African-American.
Alexis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Niall, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Absolutely.
That was Alexis Yancey and Niall Lansana, two alums of UW-Madison's newspaper by and for Black students called The Black Voice. They're with us today to talk about the story of the paper and a new documentary about it called We the Vision. It's playing at the Marquee Theater at UW-Madison tomorrow evening at 6. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Producer Carl Christensen brings us a story about Wisconsin comedian and now best-selling author Charlie Behrens.
Comedian and host of the Manitowoc Minute, Charlie Behrens, is at it again, this time with his book landing on the New York Times bestsellers list. Beta host Doug Gordon recently caught up with Charlie, where he asks him about the difference between the Manitowoc Minute guy and the real Charlie Behrens.
Well, the Manitowoc Minute version is basically just an exaggerated version of who I am. And it, you know, it's based off my time in local news where people would say I did things wrong. I said things wrong. I had an accent. Bubbler is not a word you can say in Texas, and it means the same thing in Wisconsin. And so the Manitowoc Minute version is a parody of the newsman that I was, where I doubled down on all the things people said I was doing wrong. Whereas, you know, in this book, I'm kind of coming to it more from who I really am. There's a lot of stories there growing up and everything, but the heart of both the Manitowoc Minute character and kind of who I am is the same. It's that same sort of Midwest mentality, that kind of be nice first, ask questions later.
How can I help you?
I'll just get whatever's easiest for you guys. It'll be good.
You just look at the menu and pick whatever you want.
No, I insist, whatever's easiest.
Well, spicy food is pretty quick and easy. Can you do spicy?
Yeah, I can do spicy. Yeah.
Are you sure? Cajun spicy. Let's down south Mississippi.
I've been down south. I've been to Cudahy. So.
Can you identify a turning point along your journey where you realized that your Manitowoc Minute was going to become your very own media empire?
Oh, no. I was doing stand-up because I wasn't thrilled with my job at the time. And I did this character, which would become the Manitowoc Minute character, in the comedy clubs. And I remember this one show in particular at the Comedy Store. And I said, is anybody from the Midwest? And then you see in this Los Angeles comedy club, like a quarter of the room, maybe more, had their hands up. And so, you know, and that bit always did well. No matter how much my other stand-up bombed, that would always help me recover. So I was like, oh, there's something here. So I made this video, the first video, the Manitowoc Minute.
Okay, welcome to the Manitowoc Minute. This week's episode sponsored by Bobberdown Bait Shop up there in Plover. Plover, of course, is right off 39 right before you get to Stevens Point. If you get to Stevens Point, point her back the other way. Let's get these headlines done real quick once.
And it was, I named it after a fella in that club who was talking to me. He's from Manitowoc. So I didn't think I'd do a second one. And then that first one took off. You know, I think it got 500,000 views.
Why does Midwest Life resonate with the rest of the country?
Well, you know, I think that it's one of those areas, a lot of people from other parts of the country view it as sort of the flyover states. And I think it's been largely ignored in pop culture, or it's been viewed as just kind of bland or somewhere in the middle, you know? But I think as we've kind of explored it, and there are a lot of comedians now sort of exploring the Midwest, we see these staples of our culture that you don't often think of. Once you shine a little flashlight on them, they're like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Since our show Beta airs on Wisconsin Public Radio, we always have to be careful about the kind of language that we use. Could you give us some Midwest alternatives to cuss words that we could use for when the proverbial guano hits the fan?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can say anything. Cripes is a staple. You know, and my grandpa Bob taught me that, you know, he didn't want to take the Lord's name in vain, so he would always say, cripes almighty.
Season rice. Criminy. Fudge. So you get a 1/4 inch bit and, son of a. I mean,
Jeepers cripes. Get Grandpa a beer, will ya?
Charlie Baron's book is called The Midwest Survival Guide, How We Talk, Love, Work, Drink, and Eat Everything with Ranch. You can hear the full conversation on WPR's Beta. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we find out what the Russian invasion of Ukraine means for oil prices. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Oil prices are expected to rise amid the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Energy prices were already high. The cost of a gallon of regular gas in Wisconsin is around $3.35. A year ago, that number was around $2.60. What's next? Jim Ritterbusch is the president of Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm in Galena, Illinois. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
How does the Russian invasion of Ukraine affect the balance of the world's oil markets?
Well, it's not a one-way street. The widespread assumption is that it'll keep pushing oil prices higher. But we've been leading up to this thing for a couple of weeks. And from exactly 2 weeks ago, WTI, which is the U.S. crude benchmark, has only been up about $2 per barrel. So thus far, we've had a subdued response to this thing. Today, we had a price spike of about $4 or so. But we have so many cross currents in here of a military and economic and a political nature that this market, I think, is just going to ratchet higher rather than just shoot up in a straight line.
I might have expected it to go up faster. Russia is a pretty big supplier of oil and natural gas. Can you talk about Russian production and where it fits into the global oil scene?
Sure. Russia is about the third largest producer. They may not be there for long, but they produce around 10 million barrels a day, and they export about 7.5 million barrels per day. So they've been a reliable supplier to the global market, but I think that's just about to change.
Yeah, we haven't seen, correct if I'm wrong on this, we haven't seen a full-on sanction stopping the flow of oil from Russia to other countries. If that were to happen, do you think it would put more pressure on oil prices?
Absolutely. That's the big item in this whole thing. If there's any clampdown on Russian exports, if there's a sanction against movement out of Russia regarding their Urals crude grade, then we're going to spike. Then we're going to see gasoline in your area significantly above that $4 a gallon mark. However, having said that, that's a decision that would have adverse impacts across most spaces. So here in the United States, should there be a decision to clamp down on Russian exports, then you're going to see inflation push harder and higher. In near term, I think we'll probably waffle around, gradually edge higher, and then it all depends. And you just laid out the key point here, and that regards the possibility of a sanction on Russian crude exports.
Talking to oil trading advisory firm President Jim Ritterbusch about oil prices during the Russia-Ukraine crisis. Jim, before this, now it wasn't that long ago that I was talking to you about oil prices being so low. One benchmark actually, I think, dipped negative briefly. Like, we'll pay you to take this off our hands, in effect, so we don't have to store it. How do we go from there? That was early pandemic to here, where we already had fairly high oil prices again.
Yeah, Rob, that was almost a couple of years ago, and that was the WTI crude grade that dipped into negative territory, which was certainly a unique event that we'll never see again. But going forward from that point, we've had production that's never really fully recovered for several reasons. At the same time, demand has recovered considerably as COVID and the Omicron have ramped down, and more people getting out and using their cars and consuming gasoline and heating up their homes. So we've had that huge recovery. So the demand side of that equation is very easy to explain. However, the supply side is a bit more complicated. The big oil producers have never really produced anywhere close to what they were doing before the pandemic, which was around 13 million barrels a day or so.
Yeah, what's going on there? Because you think prices are high, so Saudi Arabia might up production. Marginal producers here in the U.S. might swing back into action. Why hasn't that been happening?
Well, you're talking about economics 101 there, Rob, and that hasn't necessarily applied. Within the United States, the big oil companies, the names that you'd immediately recognize, have shifted their whole strategy. They've been burnt so many times by producing too much and watching the price fall that the past couple of years they've exercised a tremendous amount of restraint. And what they've opted to do is what I call emphasize value over growth. So in this kind of growing production, they're emphasizing value by returning money to their shareholders. And that's taken two forms. One, they bought back shares. And secondly, they've tossed out some pretty attractive dividends. So, you know, crude production in the U.S. has recovered about 11.6 million barrels. And again, that compares with 13 million before the pandemic. So we've got a ways to go before we get there. And these U.S. producers aren't showing any inclination as far as trading or changing their strategy. Now, on the Saudi side, they're within this organization called OPEC Plus, and they've had a mandate to gradually feed extra oil back into the market at a pace of about 400,000 barrels per day. The bad news is that just hasn't been enough to keep pace with this strong demand that we've seen.
Jim, I'm seeing some of the big name companies you mentioned are cutting their ties with Gazprom, the Russian. I think this is mostly a story about natural gas production. Is something comparable happening with oil production? We're seeing international companies get out of partnerships with Russian companies. If so, is that meaningful?
It's meaningful at the margin. Thus far, it's not going to make a lot of difference. These have been primarily European countries, such as companies such as Shell and BP, I believe, pulled out of Russia here today. But on a broader scale, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference. And I think the big difference will be of an economic nature. I think this Russian economy is just going to get beaten down so bad by the sanctions and by the adversity surrounding this whole mess that that could prompt a decision to pull back out of Ukraine. But just today, the Russian ruble, the currency, was driven down to new lows. I think it's been down maybe 50% in less than a week. The Russian stock market didn't open today, and I'm being told it won't open tomorrow. But ETFs that replicate the Russian stock market are off, I believe, 27% just today. So this is going to enact a tremendous amount of pain on Russia, and there's nothing like economics to bring somebody to the bargaining table to have a serious discussion.
And Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Jim Ritterbusch, president of Ritterbusch & Associates, looking at oil prices during Russia's attack on Ukraine. Tomorrow on Central Time, a new project in Wisconsin tackles loneliness, that and more, tomorrow here on Central Time.